every dive operator will say to you, oh, we can cater for vegans and vegetarians. And then, I mean, in all honesty, that might just be a garden salad and French fries for breakfast, dinner, and lunch.
Off-Gassing, a scuba podcast with host Nick Hogle. Traveling these days has its challenges. Add in some diving gear and exotic destinations, now those fleeting moments of excitement can soon turn into stress. One of my favorite and most exciting things about traveling is the cuisine. Imagine arriving at your destination only to find out that your dietary requirements are met with mediocrity and little to no choices. In this episode, I speak with Brett Robertson, founder of Infinite Blue Dive Travel, a company that brings you to unique dive destinations, raises your environmental consciousness, removes the stress from making those travel plans, and creates better options for individuals on vegan, plant-based, or adapted diets. Please enjoy. Brett, how are you doing this evening?
Good, thank you. Yeah, over here in New Zealand, it's all good. It's been a pretty awesome summer and kind of getting into the tail end of the summer now. It's great. Yeah, how are you?
I am doing good. I am just trying to catch up. I was trying to catch up on some editing today, and that's why I kind of lost track of time. I'm trying to get all these episodes kind of uploaded because I'll be traveling basically the next couple of weeks, almost 3 weeks. So I'm trying to get as much done as possible before I hit the road. About to head back to the States here this week, so it should be fun and exciting.
Well, that sounds pretty cool. Why on earth are you going back to the States?
I'm a glutton for punishment. I'm from the States, so my family lives in Texas. It's been about, I think, 19, almost 20 months since I've been back, so I'm just going back to see the family, see my mother, see the nieces and nephews, my sister, just hang out, get some Texas barbecue, you know, just the basics, you know.
So. Awesome. Sounds good.
Yeah. So my first question I wanted to throw out at you is, tell me about that first breath underwater. What led to that moment? The what, the how, the why? Was it love at first breath? Was it, I absolutely hate this, I'm never doing this again? Tell me all about it.
Well, I'm not sure that I ever really intended on going diving in the first place. I think I started back in about 2001 when I was living in Taiwan, and I had a bit of a holiday break. So I scooted over to Thailand for a bit of a holiday. And I was pretty much planning on heading north and, you know, going into the jungles and things like that. And then someone mentioned to me that there's a chance of seeing whale sharks in the Gulf of Thailand, a little island called Koh Tao. And so I thought, well, that sounds pretty good. I might, you know, skip the jungles and the rice paddies and things and head down to the Gulf of Thailand instead. So I headed down to Koh Tao, and I started my open water course there. And it was great. No, I loved it. There wasn't anything painful about it at all. It was actually pretty good. My instructor was a beautiful German woman, and I think I fell in love at first sight. It was far from painful, you know, plenty of fish, lots of coral, no whale sharks, but no, it was great.
I've actually never been to Koh Tao. My first dive ever, actually, my first breaths underwater were in Koh Phi Phi, and I was kind of just doing the backpacking thing as well. And when I first got there, it was like, okay, I'm going to be spending some time on the beaches. I'm going to buy this cheap little snorkel kit just to kind of, you know, hang out and see what's going on. And then I started seeing underwater. I'm like, wow, there's a lot of life under there. I need to check this out more. And ended up doing my first dive in Koh Phi Phi. So that's awesome. But I have not been to Koh Tao yet. I've heard wonderful things about it. And I'll have to make, and there's a couple shops, a couple people I'd like to visit up there. So I'll have to make it there at some point.
Yeah, Koh Tao's, it's a good place. I would say the diving is not necessarily exceptional. but in terms of lifestyle and incredibly professional dive centers, you can definitely learn a lot For sure. I mean, I ended up going back to Koh Tao. So I did my open water in Koh Tao, and then I did my advanced in Koh Tao, and then I did my dive master in Koh Tao. Rescue was somewhere else. Where did I do my rescue? Rescue was Taiwan. And eventually my instructor as well, I also did in Koh Tao. So I must have liked it. I must have liked something about the place. But no, it was good. It was good. Wonderful lifestyle, fantastic people, really professional, and a lot of very environmentally conscious dive shops as well. So they strive to preserve what they have remaining, I guess.
So when you took those first courses, like, did you do open water and then immediately go into advanced, or was there a little bit of time in between?
I didn't have so long. I think I only had a week or something down there. So I sort of split them up. Open water course, and then I came back to Koh Tao my next holiday, 2 or 3 months down the track, and did my AOW then.
Oh, okay. When you completed your open water, did you know this is it? This is for me. I need to keep pursuing this, or was it kind of a gradual progression?
Good question. No, I think I was hooked straight away. And the reason why I didn't do my advanced after my open water was because I was having too much fun diving. It wasn't, I spent days fun diving, really. I was very hard to market to for an open water course for the instructors. But in terms of fun diving, did plenty of that. At the time, there's one dive site off Koh Tao called Champon Pinnacle, and it really is probably one of the two premier dive sites in the Gulf of Thailand. And it's where the whale sharks are when they come. And at that point, back in the beginning of 2000s, there were quite a few bull sharks around Champon Pinnacle. So yeah, I loved it. I was straight into the fun diving and out at Champon checking out bull sharks, and I was completely hooked.
And then you said you did your rescue in Taiwan. How did that all come about? Just traveling for fun there, or?
I lived in Taiwan for 5 years, I guess, and it was tough because everything in the rescue course, you can imagine all the tech. Or the sort of more the more difficult language for emergency first response and all the rescue techniques were all in traditional Chinese. And even though I'd been studying Chinese, it was incredibly difficult to understand. But I was living in Taipei, and there's a little place about a couple of hours out of Taipei called Longdong, and we would go out there every weekend to get out of the city and dive. Which was, yeah, super nice. Head up there on Friday night, come back on Sunday afternoon, and get a couple of days diving in. And so I ended up doing my rescue course out there.
If you don't mind me asking, what brought you to Taiwan? Was it for work, I'm assuming?
Yeah, well, like you, I was sort of backpacking around, really, and I ended up in Bangkok, as you do. With very little money left, and somebody suggested to me that I could go to Taiwan and start teaching in Taiwan, teaching English, and it was something that I planned on doing anyway when I finished university, but hadn't sort of taken it up and ended up traveling instead, and thought, okay, I'll pop over to Taiwan, and there I stayed, yeah, 5 years. I ended up going to Chinese language school and studying Mandarin, and spent a good 5 years studying Chinese Kung Fu as well, which was good. A bit of diving and a little bit of teaching English.
Oh, that's awesome. I just took my TEFL course last year, because it's something that I'd like to try to get into, kind of. I don't want to call it like supplemental income, because I've volunteered and taught English before, and I actually really enjoyed it. So that's kind of, I was like, oh, this is something I could probably do. And just moving out here, I was able to take just kind of an online TEFL course, and I need to complete some volunteer hours, and then the certificate will be good. And then hopefully I can start kind of seeking out and, maybe just doing it like part time throughout the week or something.
I've got quite a few friends who are teaching diving, and they supplement their income with online teaching, actually. So teaching English online and then getting courses when they can do them. And they travel around the world doing just that, you know, teaching scuba, doing some great diving, and supplementing, as you say, their income with a bit of English teaching. It's pretty good.
Yeah, yeah. I figured I can just teach, you know, teach part of the world some really bad English. So,
yeah, my colleague in Infinite Blue is from the States, and he teaches English, and we're constantly arguing about which English is correct, and it's certainly not American English. I don't know what that is. You remove all the vowels.
So this is kind of just a random funny story. So when I moved from, I moved here from Texas to Malaysia. And when I moved here, you know, I got a phone out here. I got a Malaysian phone number. And it's funny because the auto type, like when you're typing, it will revert to the British way of spelling as opposed to the American way of spelling. And it's funny because there's just some slight little things, like, you know, instead of Z, they'll use S. And so now I find myself back and forth just going, like, depending on how I'm writing or whatnot, I'll be like, oh, you know, put a Z in there instead of an S. Or now I'll put it. It's just like this a random stupid thing. But I do find it interesting. But enough about that talk. Let's get back to the diving.
Oh, diving? Yeah, so, that's right.
Yeah, diving. Well, I'm actually I'm curious to hear more about the business, but just to bring it back a little bit. So you did your rescue in Taiwan, and then you went back to do your DM and instructor course in Koh Tao?
Yeah, so I left Taiwan in end of 2004 and came back to New Zealand for a while. And then from Taiwan, I would get holidays that were 2 months long. School breaks were 2 months long, and I get lots of 2 month holidays a year. So in that time, I had plenty of time to go diving around Southeast Asia. So, you know, I spent a good couple of months traveling through the Philippines, diving all the way through the Philippines, pretty much all the way through Thailand, a little bit in Malaysia. And so by the time I got back to New Zealand, I was just sort of itching to get back to Southeast Asia and, you know, tropical waters and get some diving in. And so I decided to head back to Koh Tao and do my dive master course, just as a bit of a lifestyle change, I guess, and to do something I was really enjoying at the time, which was good. That took about 2 or 3 months, and I did loads and loads of dives and learned a lot. It was great. And then after I finished, somebody came in from one of the bigger shops on the island and said, "I hear you speak Chinese." And I said, "Yep, I do." And at that time, Chinese, mainly from mainland China, a few from Taiwan, were starting to come to Thailand for holidays and things. And there were a few more Chinese tourists coming to Koh Tao. And there was not one single Chinese-speaking instructor on the island. And so they basically said to me, if you come and do your IDC with us and you stay and work for us, then we'll give you a free IDC, apart from a few costs for Patty and stuff. So I thought that was a pretty good idea. So yeah, that's how it happened. I ended up doing my instructor course and then working at a big shop on Koh Tao, and I was there for a good couple of years, I think. Yeah.
How did you find going from, you know, just I guess the way that I'll put it is like a non-pro into the professional side of it. Now you're teaching. Now you're the role model, essentially. How did you find that whole transition?
It wasn't too difficult, really. I didn't really think about it too much. I was more concerned about how on earth do I teach Chinese people how to say things like, how do I say regulator in Chinese? How do I say, you know, a tank? Just simple, a BCD, how on earth do you say that in Chinese? I was sort of more concerned with, I had to do a whole lot more Chinese study. And even then, it was very difficult, you know, you have to figure out, you wouldn't know the word for something. So you would have to say, you know, the thing that you put in your mouth and suck on, or the kind of bottle-like thing full of air, until I finally got it down and figured out what the technical terms for everything were. So I didn't think about that too much. It just sort of happens. And it was a progression of study, really.
And then you said you stuck around there for a few years. Why did you decide to leave, just kind of getting over the island life?
That's another long story, actually. After I've been teaching it was quite successful. I think I hit the right time for Chinese tourism. It was when the stock market was booming in Shanghai and Beijing, and there's a lot of money around, and people were leaving Beijing and Shanghai and mainly those two cities, a little bit Guangzhou. And they were starting to come over, and I just happened to be the Johnny on the spot, I suppose. And I was overwhelmed. I was completely overwhelmed with Chinese divers. It was crazy. I had classes, open water classes with, 25, 30 people, which was just absolutely balmy. I had my other instructors helping me out and things, but I'd be doing lectures to 25 or 30 people. It was crazy. And it sort of, people began to notice, I guess, and people were like wanting me to help them out with Chinese marketing and stuff like that. And someone, one of the instructors I worked with at the dive center on Koh Tao, was starting a liveaboard company over in the Similan Islands on the west coast of Thailand. And he asked if I would like to come in and join in with what they were doing. And at that time, they had a 24-meter wooden yacht, which was sailed up from Indonesia. And they had converted that into a liveaboard for the Similans and had just started building a 35-meter yacht in Indonesia. And so I came along and sort of started up, basically, which was kind of a new company in the west coast of Thailand with them. And so I spent time between Koh Tao and over in the Similan Islands over there, over in the west coast.
Was that your first time being involved in a startup? I'm sure there were some challenges that went along with that.
Yeah, the challenge was hard work, like really, really, really hard work. It was 24/7. Once we'd finished building the second boat in Indonesia, she was brought up to Thailand. So then we had two boats running, and we were working on the boats. I was on the smaller boat for quite a while, and that was, I would pilot the boat through the night, 2 hours on and off with the captain. I would check out the engine room and do engine duty with the engineer. And I would be guiding dives, 4 dives a day as well in the Similans. It was pretty, and filling all the tanks on the boat as well. It was pretty full on. It wasn't the relaxing dive dream that people think it was. It was a lot of hard work.
So I actually have not been to the Similan. To be honest, I've actually only been diving in a few places in Thailand. What is the diving like in the Similan? I've actually heard it's some of the best, if not the best, in Thailand.
Yeah, it does have some of the best sites in Thailand. There's a couple down south which are really good, which are more south from Koh Phi Phi, called Hindang and Hinwong, which are incredible. I'm not sure if you've heard of those.
No.
Okay, they're probably closer to Koh Lipe. So okay. From Koh Phi Phi, it's a little bit south, and then out in the middle of the ocean. And they're both pinnacle dives. Hindang is one of the places where you can frequently see Pacific manta. It's an incredible dive site. The Similans, on the other hand, also has a bunch of incredible dive sites, whether it's coral reefs. East of Eden is beautiful. It's stunning, really. East of Eden has a coral bommie on it that National Geographic came and filmed over a long period of time. It's stunning. But they also have incredible seascapes, huge boulder cities, like Elephant Head Rock, Elephant Head Pinnacle, and yeah, really, really nice stuff. North of Similans, there's Koh Bon, which is where you see the manta in Thailand, mostly they seem to sort of congregate there. And then there's Richelieu Rock as well, which is up close to the border of Burma, which is a stunning, another stunning dive site. We would run the trips up and down the west coast. And then when the monsoons came over, we would do this horrendous, absolutely horrendous trip where we would take the boat down from Phuket through Penang, down the coast of Malaysia, through the Straits of Malacca, Singapore, up the other side of Malaysia and back up to the Gulf of Thailand, which took about 3 weeks. And we did, I don't know how many dives, three or four dives a day. And we would go and sit back in the Gulf of Thailand for 3 or 4 months while the monsoon was hitting the west coast. And we'd run small dive trips there. And then we'd do the 3 week trip back around to try and catch the Formula One in Singapore on the way through. And then back up to Similan Islands, which is something. I don't recommend being on a boat with 12 people in close confines for 3 weeks. It can be an intimidating experience.
I'm sure. Did you ever brave the Malacca Strait, the Straits of Malacca, and try to do any diving in there?
No. We spent most of our time avoiding boats. It was scary, very scary. Yeah, it was an international shipping lane, and we were on this little 24 meter long wooden yacht, and we're sort of rocking our way through amongst these huge, huge ocean liners and things. And I guess rather sad ending to that story was that boat actually got hit by one of the liners coming off its mooring and sank.
Oh, wow. Where did that happen?
Just up the east coast of Malaysia. I forget the city it was now. Can't quite recall. But yeah, it was one of the ports on the east coast of Malaysia, and one of the boats was coming off its moorings and not giving way like it should. And unfortunately, our little wooden yacht got sucked up into the engine at the back and got turned into splinters. Yeah, it wasn't very good.
Oh, wow. Wow. Yeah, no, hopefully nobody was hurt.
Oh, Kuantan.
Oh, okay.
No, what happened was a Thai fishing boat came by and picked them up. And we had, the captain was Thai, the engineer was Thai, as the chef was Thai, and then a friend of mine was the cruise director. And they picked them up and put them on their fishing boats. And in Thailand, it wasn't good luck to have somebody who'd been involved in a boat sinking on your boat, apparently. This is what my friend was telling me. And so he'd been lifted up onto the boat, and he'd lost all his clothes, and he was cold and frightened. And the Thai captain is taking him back to port in Kuantan and spitting on him to make sure that the evil spirits didn't harm him. So he was sort of sitting there after this horrible thing had happened. He borrowed someone's cell phone and gave me a call and said the boat had gone down and the captain's spitting on me, and my thumb is hanging by a piece of skin, and I'm gonna try and get into Kuantan and go to the hospital. And they got to Kuantan. He went to hospital and the crew were okay, and I headed down and I met him in hospital, and he felt really bad about what had happened. And he showed me his thumb, and they'd sewed his thumb back on the wrong way. And I said, dude, we have to go to a new hospital, and you've got to do this the correct way. And he felt so bad about what had happened. He took it upon himself that he's now gone through life with his thumb back to front as a reminder of the horrible occasion. Poor guy.
Yeah, that's definitely a reminder for sure. That's a bummer. Well, I'm glad that there was no... Could have been a lot more tragic, I guess.
It could have been a lot more tragic.
Yeah. I've actually been to Koh Lipe, and I really, really enjoy Koh Lipe. I can't remember if I said in the email, but I actually live in Penang. So I mean, obviously haven't been on a boat through the strait or anything like that, but we live pretty much right at the mouth of it in Penang area. So have you been to Penang?
Penang, yeah, I've been to Penang a couple of times. I'd head down there from Thailand for a bit of a break. And when we're taking the boat down there, we would stop in, and because everything's duty-free, right? Everything's sort of tax-free.
Langkawi is. I know Langkawi is.
Yes, Langkawi. Yeah, we're popping to Penang for a couple of days and sort of restock on things and before we headed off. But I haven't done any. I haven't been diving in the area. Is there anywhere to dive there? I've been diving further south, but not in Penang.
No diving.
No.
The closest is Langkawi and then Koh Lipe, and that's why we actually would go to Koh Lipe, just because it's a very short plane ride. You fly into Langkawi and then take a boat over into Koh Lipe. And I actually really, really enjoyed my time in Koh Lipe to the point where I don't know if we're going back there anytime soon, but it's close enough to where we want to start making it more frequent because it's such an easy place to get to.
Right, right. Yeah, Koh Lipe has got some really nice dive sites. I think it's called 8 Mile. Was the one I've dived a few times, which is the pinnacle out from 8 miles, actually, out from Koh Lipe.
Yeah. Actually, I did one dive there, and it was, what was it? The visibility was really, really bad, but it was just kind of nice to do something different because we were kind of just, most of the times we were going around the islands, right, pretty much. I can't remember the name of it, but it's just right across the waters, super close where a lot of the dive sites that we went to were. I can't remember the very popular dive site, Steps or, yeah, I can't remember. But yeah, I really, really enjoyed it. But tell me a little bit about Infinite Blue Dive Travel. How did that all come about? Tell me about what you guys are doing there.
Okay, there's sort of a step in between, if you don't mind.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, I told you it was going to be a long one. So the Liverpool company expanded quite rapidly. I think we were building a boat a year in the end. And so we had boats in Palau and Maldives and Fiji and Philippines and stuff. And it was all getting quite a lot of work. So I decided to chill out a bit and sort of forgetting, you know, what I was doing diving for in the first place. So I made the decision to head to the Philippines, where the diving, I'd always had really, really good diving whenever I'd been there. And there was a place which had started to get, you know, a little bit of bustle with tourism called Bohol. And so I thought, okay, this could be good. You know, I'll start working with a dive shop there and go back to my roots and do a few courses and things like that. So I headed over to Bohol, started working with a dive shop in Bohol. And yet again, I seem to be just incredibly lucky. Chinese tourism hit Bohol like nothing else. And I was run off my feet again, but in a good way. It was really good. And we managed to expand and get some property there. And we built a instructor development center in Bohol, which was one of the first IDCs there that was just specifically purpose-built for IDCs, so the swimming pool and classrooms and everything like that. And yeah, I did my course director course in 2014, I think it was. So we started doing a lot of instructor development courses there. And when, I guess, this all leads up to Infinite Blue Travel, was the fact that I've been a vegetarian for 25, almost 30 years, and vegan for a long time now. And that was kind of interwoven with one of the reasons why I was teaching diving in the first place, was to try and instill in students some environmental consciousness, I suppose, and care for the environment. And going back to teaching open water courses in Bohol allowed me to do that. And especially with a lot of the divers that I had, the students I had, they were very fish oriented, you know, seafood and things like that, especially from Hong Kong and the south of China. So I kind of took it upon myself to try and educate them about what was going on in the oceans and why you should probably not be eating seafood, or at least sustainably sourced seafood. And at that time, shark finning was a big thing. One of the things that I jumped on the back of was, you know, shark fin soup. And so I started a couple of viral campaigns, which went quite well, against shark finning. And a lot of my students took it on board. It was great. You know, they went back to China and they had their weddings and they had signs with no shark fin and things like that at their wedding. So it was kind of a success, really. It was really good. And that dive shop was called Infinite Blue. And I thought to myself, well, if I can influence dive students to become more aware about the environment and the marine environment, then if I can expand that into IDCs where I can teach instructors to teach their students to be more aware about the environment, then maybe we have even a better chance. So I found that by doing that, I was able to sort of hopefully influence more people in a better way. And we had a lot of good feedback and we had a lot of success, I think. We started the first Sea Shepherd dive shop in the world in Bohol. Sea Shepherd Asia actually had an arm called Sea Shepherd Dive, which we started, which was focused on coral reef restoration and things like that. And so we did a lot of that. And that sort of eventually led to where you're going with Infinite Blue Dive Travel.
So the teaching that you were doing in Bohol, You wanted to grow it, so that's kind of why you went into more of the liveaboard or Infinite Blue Travel. You just wanted to kind of expand on, instead of staying in one little area, you wanted to expand on it?
Yeah, well, COVID came along, and Infinite Blue expanded into another island as well called Darwin, and we had a dive resort there. But then COVID came along, and financially things were very difficult, and I decided I wanted to move away as well from the dive centers a little bit, because it had been a very full-on period of time. And I wanted to take a step back and focus more on dive travel. And so I started Infinite Blue Dive Travel in about 2019. And the focus that one of the things I want to achieve is to try and pressure dive operators to provide service for vegan divers and people on adapted diets. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No. It definitely does. Because, so I'll be honest, I will go back and forth. I do eat meat, and I have tried, you know, there's, I think the longest amount of time is I went about 3 or 4 months at one point where I didn't eat any meat, and it was really good. And usually how it ends up ending is because I'm traveling and it's hard to find some sort of vegetarian option, or it's hard to find an option. And that was actually one of the things when I saw it, when I came across your channel or your the Infinite Blue Travel, I was like, oh, this is something different, because there's a lot. And I'm sure, you know, there's a lot of places that will be like, oh, we offer vegan or vegetarian meals. There's kind of usually an option most of the time these days. But to find one that's just focused on, no, this is, you know, we're focused on meat-free travel. I don't know if that makes sense, meat-free travel. But yeah, no. So it does make sense what you're saying.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, as a vegetarian or a vegan, that there's been so many times in the past, and being heavily involved in the liveaboard industry, you'd see it all the time as well, where I would hop onto a boat for 10 days and the chef would be, oh, so you're vegan. Does that mean you don't eat fish? I'm like, oh, no, this is going to be a disaster. 10 days with spaghetti and tomato paste or something like that. And I just think that I know it's very niche, but operators should be able to provide the same level of service for those on vegetarian or vegan diets as they do for the status quo. And in the liveaboard industry, some of it is more high end. It's pricier. The amount of money people pay can be $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 US dollars for a trip, you know. The status quo is still very much steak and eggs and a big chunk of fish and some crabs or whatever. And I think given the state of the oceans and the amount that we actually understand about it now, it's sort of time to make a bit of a change. High time a bit of a change was made. And also these operators, they work in delicate marine environments where they should actively be encouraging people not to devour the habitat that they're using for a living. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, it does. Because actually the last, at some point last year, it was October of last year. We were traveling. We were actually on Tiaman on the east coast of Peninsular Malaysia. And I saw a friend there. Ended up meeting up a friend. I didn't know he was going to be there. He just kind of happened to be there at the same time as me. And he's a vegetarian. And he was telling me, he's like, yeah, it's not bad for the first like day or two, but I'm basically just sick and tired of eating rice and vegetables because that's the only option that they'll give him. And I'll be even honest with you, when this is probably about 2 years ago now, you know, me and my girlfriend were like, hey, let's just do a vegetarian diet for a little bit. You know, I do see the health. We do see the health benefits. It's definitely a healthier way to go. And at first it was a little bit tough. I'm not going to lie, to try to create meals until you kind of start to figure it out and you're like, oh, okay, I can do this with that. And then actually make a pretty tasty meal. It's not just, you know, chips and mac and cheese or something like that. So, so it is nice to be able to see that you're offering something like this, because there is a big portion of the community that I do feel that are vegetarian or vegan, and there, it is a hard time for them to be able to go on trips, or maybe they're trying to bring their own food, which never really works out very well because it's only going to be so long before, you know, you run out, or you know, you can't bring a whole shopping or big couple grocery bags, I'm sure, on a liveaboard. So you found dive operators to work with you. How is that going so far? Was it kind of a hard, was it foreign to them? Like what? Or was it something that they kind of had to adapt to?
Well, that's the thing that you find when you connect with a lot of dive operators. Every dive operator will say to you, oh, we can cater for vegans and vegetarians. And then, I mean, in all honesty, that might just be a garden salad and French fries for breakfast, dinner, and lunch. Maybe some soup and a pancake for breakfast. And I think it's just a lot of education is needed. I mean, they definitely have vegan divers that come on their trips and they go away unhappy. I have loads of people, you know, get in touch with me and give me horror stories of being stuck on vessels or at dive resorts, which said, you know, we can cater for you, but they just clearly have no idea at all. So we've managed to build up a good solid base of, or getting there. I mean, it's taking a long time. We hope to have operators in all regions that have proven menus and a proven record for being able to cater for plant-based eating. And we've actually helped quite a few resorts to write their menus, plant-based menus and things, which is great. They've been sticking to it and had really good reports and things like that. So it's just a sort of a slow process, really. It's incredibly niche, but I think as the older generation of divers become older and start to retire from dive trips, and the younger generation is coming through, I think a lot more people are aware and are changing their diets because of this awareness. And, you know, at some stage, dive operators are going to have to change what they're doing in order to adapt and for their own financial survival, I suppose. And so, yeah, it's a slow change, but I think it's going to become very important down the track.
What are some of the destinations that you cater or travel to, I should say?
Well, Infinite Blue Dive Travel, we kind of anywhere around the world where we have operators that, you know, can prove themselves to cater for vegans and places that we've, you know, been to and experienced ourselves. At the moment, I would say a lot of it is concentrated in Indonesia. We have a lot of people coming to Indonesia. So diving Komodo National Park, Raja Ampat is a big one. A lot of people are diving in Raja now. Also Philippines as well. And also we had a few people in Socorro and Galapagos as well. But I guess the main focus has really been on Southeast Asia and probably Indonesia, which is Indonesia is very good to for catering for vegans. Their cuisine is just sort of leans to that very easily, and the religious undertones and culture and everything are very inclusive, I guess.
Okay, so I'm just curious, what type of, like, do you just send the operator a checklist, like, hey, like how do you vet some of these operators to make sure that they'll be up to par for a travel operator that you would use?
Yeah, well, it's not easy. I guess just through years and years of dive shows that I've been done with the Liverboard Company and resorts and things, I've met a lot of people in the industry. So we just sort of take it from there, really. And we try and figure out what they have to offer vegan and or plant-based divers. And we run through menus with them. And then we get on the ground and go and see them and visit the resorts and the liverboards, talk to the kitchens, do the liverboard trips, and see how well it lives up to what they say they're providing.
That must be the worst part of the job, huh?
Oh, you mean like eating really good food and diving really good diving? It sucks, man. It's terrible.
How has the feedback been with customers and guests that have been using Infinite Blue?
Yeah, so far it's been really good. But then again, you know, we're dealing with some wonderful people who have had some pretty bad experiences in the past. So now they're finally being taken care of, as they should be, by liverboard operators or dive resorts and things. So yeah, they generally come away pretty happy. And yeah, we've had a number of return guests, which has been great.
My last couple of questions for you is liveaboard or land-based? What is your preferred option, personal?
Oh, Christ, that's a tough one. I still love the feeling of a liveaboard. When I'm going on a dive holiday, I really like to be immersed in everything, really. And I find, you know, if you're at a dive resort, maybe you want to, you know, head into town or go on a sightseeing trip or jump on a motorbike or whatever, and which is kind of cool. But when I'm diving in somewhere remote, I just want to be in a boat and dive and come up and sleep and eat and dive again, really. And it's very special being on a liverboard, I think, in a really remote location and with very few other people around. And yeah, it's a very special feeling. So for me, definitely, I prefer liverboards personally, but there's also a lot going for resorts as well, you know, when they provide other aspects to your dive holiday as well.
And then my last question is kind of a two-parter. And besides the obvious answer of call us at Infinite Blue, but if you are a vegetarian, you're a vegan, and you're looking to book a trip, what are some steps that you could take to ensure that your dietary requirements will be met?
You mean aside from just getting in touch with us?
Yeah.
I think a lot has to do with getting in touch with the operator directly, like actually getting in touch with them, you know, giving them a call, getting them on WhatsApp, having a conversation with them, getting them to send you through an example of their menu, which is always a good idea. I mean, some places will say that they can provide and then they won't have a menu in mind, and you'll get there and they'll just make something on the fly and hope that it's okay. So, you know, get hold of them in advance, ask them to prepare, give them some ideas. A lot of places don't actually know what to prepare. I mean, it's hard for me to conceive, but they just think that all we can eat is a bit of lettuce and a spud, and they actually have no idea that they can't conceptualize a meal without at least like a shrimp in it or something. So it's quite a good idea to actually say, hey, you know, I can help you out here. I can give you some ideas and stuff like that. And actually have a conversation about it with them. And more often than not, they're actually quite relieved to have a bit of input rather than them having to come up with something themselves. So, yeah, it's all about, you know, getting in touch and having that conversation with the place where you're going. Because, you know, if you're planning a dive trip, it's not cheap. You know, if you're flying halfway across the world and transport and hotels and everything like this, so you really want to enjoy it and you want to have the sustenance and nutrition to keep on diving and do it safely. And anyway, you should be taken care of just as well as anyone else that's not plant-based as well.
Awesome, awesome. But I would suggest any one of my listeners out there that if that is the route you're going to go, that you definitely contact Infinite Blue Dive Travel because they will help you out.
Certainly. Definitely. Do this.
Well, Brett, I really, really want to thank you for coming on to the podcast. Obviously, the listeners will not know, but we definitely had some technical difficulties in this recording. But I really appreciate your patience, and I absolutely appreciate you coming on to the podcast today.
Well, it's been great. I've enjoyed it. I hope we get to do it again another time soon.
Off-gassing, a scuba podcast.